Okay. So this is going to be just a very simple introduction to meditation and to how to deal with the retreat situation. It's going to be very basic. I'm just basically standing in for Ajahn Brahm. So tomorrow morning you get the real thing, yeah. But tonight is going to be the basic stuff. So the first thing is to remember that when you come now from a very busy life in Singapore or wherever it is that you come from, it's going to take a while before you start to calm down and become peaceful, and you feel that this kind of the energy of this place takes over your mind and you start to feel, wow, this is really working for yourself. So take it easy, take it slowly in the beginning. Don't force your meditation, don't sit too long, don't do things which are not helpful for becoming peaceful. Take it slowly, and after a few days, maybe 2 or 3 days, you start to feel things are settling down. You're losing the memories of Singapore or wherever it is that you come from. It's all fading into the past, and you become part of this meditation center instead. So allow things to happen very, very slowly, very, very gradually, and then you find that this is the fastest way. Forcing yourself is never going to be fast. And it's one of the wonderful things, I think, when you're all coming here. I know in Singapore you don't have that many holidays. You have maybe a couple of weeks a year. And it's great that you actually take the opportunity, instead of going to some kind of exotic place somewhere, some kind of holiday, expensive holiday destination. Instead you come to a retreat center like this. It's a wonderful and praiseworthy thing. And I always hear people say they go to some expensive place, to Paris or I don't know what sort of place. And very often they come back from these places and they feel more exhausted when they come back than when they actually left. It's supposed to be a holiday, it's supposed to feel relaxed, you're supposed to feel at ease. But in fact, you actually feel worse than when you departed. And people come back and they say, oh, I'm really happy now, I can go back to work again so I can relax because the holiday was so exhausting. So in fact, I think by coming to a retreat center and doing a meditation retreat instead, this is the real kind of holiday. This is the holiday where you actually can relax, you actually can find that ease of the mind, the ease of the body, where you find that you come back to Singapore or back to wherever you come from, and you find that you have more energy than you had before. You're more positive, you're more able to help out also for other people, or more able to help out with whatever thing you're doing in life. And that is what a real holiday is about. So this is the real deal that you are getting here at this retreat center, as far as I'm concerned. So this is the right way of doing a holiday. But again, be careful. Be careful. Go slowly. Don't force yourself too much. I remember when I was in Singapore a couple of years ago, I was staying with this man. He was actually a Malaysian man, but he was working in Singapore. And he told me that he had been on a meditation retreat. And he said, never again in my whole life do I want to go on a meditation retreat. Why? Because I felt so tense, he said, so uptight, so I couldn't relax. It was a terrible thing. Why on earth would I ever want to go on a meditation retreat again? And I tried to sort of persuade him by saying, well, you know, not all meditation retreats are the same. They vary depending on who your teacher is, what kind of technique you're using, and all these kind of things. So don't give up so easily. But he was very adamant that meditation was just some kind of torture, basically. So be careful with that. Don't make meditation into torture. It's supposed to be the exact opposite of torture. It's supposed to be a sense of ease, of relaxedness, of feeling good about yourself. So if you find that you are moving too much into the torture zone, then relax a little bit and do something else instead, rather than trying to meditate too hard. So use the center here. It's a beautiful place. I was just sitting now during the meditation, just feeling the peace of this place. It's wonderful. I'm sure when you come from a place, most of you come from cities, or even if it's not a city, it's difficult to find a place as peaceful as this. It is really, really peaceful. So enjoy that. Take the opportunity. Go for walks if you want to into nature here. There's a vast land, actually. There's 150 acres that this retreat center is on. And there's even more land outside of that where you can actually go for walks. Enjoy that. Look at the trees, look at the sun, look at the birds, look at the kangaroos, look at the wildlife, and enjoy that. It's one of the things which I notice when I read the suttas of the Buddha. In particular, there is a particular collection of suttas called the Theragata. These are the verses of the elder monks. And in there, you often find the praise of nature by these very senior arahats. These were the full enlightened monks at that time. And they would talk about the nature around them, the beautiful trees, the beautiful mountains, the beautiful birds, the animals and everything. And they would praise that. They would say, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it beautiful? So this is like one of the allowable, if you like, joys that you can take with you while you're here. So don't neglect that, particularly if you feel that we all need time apart from meditation practice. So when you do that, go for a walk and enjoy yourself. Enjoy the nature and see the beauty of the nature around you. That is always a wonderful way of doing it. Follow the example of the arahats. If the arahats could do it, we can surely also do it. So that is, so try this, be careful with yourself, pace yourself, know that this is not a competition. You're not here to sort of outpace the fellow sitting next to you or the girl sitting next to you. It's not some kind of, it's not nothing to do with other people. It's got everything to do with yourself. Just look at yourself. Don't look at anybody else. And then when you look at yourself, you find out what you need, what you require. Whether you are too tense, whether you're too slack. Feel your body, look at your mind. And then you slowly, gradually, you know what you require, what you need, what is going to work for you. Don't worry about anybody else. Allow other people to do what they need and what they require to do. One of the ways of looking at this path of meditation is, of course, the middle way. The middle way is one of the first and the fundamental teachings of the Buddha. And one way of understanding the middle way, well, first of all, you know, of course, that one extreme in the middle way is indulgence in sensual pleasures. And when you come to a retreat center like this, it's very hard to indulge too much because there's nothing really here that you can indulge in. So you don't have to worry too much about that side of things. It's the other side that you have to be more careful about, because when you come from an ordinary lifestyle, when you're used to having a television around you, when you're used to all the comforts, when you're used to having an evening meal, you're used to be able to do all kinds of things to distract yourself, and suddenly you find yourself in a retreat center. It can be a shock to the system. It can be a shock to how you your reaction can be one of maybe suppressing or oppressing yourself. So be careful with that. Because if you do that, you find that your meditation does not progress. And the problem with if you become too suppressed, if you have pain in the body, if you have maybe even your mind becomes too stiff, what happens is that the mind becomes preoccupied with that pain. The pain becomes important because pain is something you don't want to have. The mind doesn't want to have that. So the mind becomes preoccupied with the pain. It's just like if you have indulge in sensuality, if you indulge too much, then the mind becomes preoccupied by the indulgence, because the mind wants happiness, it wants pleasure. So by indulging, the mind goes to that pleasure. In the same way, if you do something which is painful, the mind goes to the pain, because it's frightened of pain, it doesn't want the pain. So the beautiful middle way of Buddhism is the way where the mind is neither preoccupied with the pleasures of the body, nor with the pains of the body. And then when you're neither preoccupied with the pain nor with the pleasure, you find that the body tends to fall away, because it isn't important anymore. When there's no pain there, when there's no pleasure there, the body is not important. It falls away. There's no reason why the mind will focus on the body anymore. So this is the trick of the middle way. The middle way is this narrow gap in between pleasure and between pain, when the body disappears. And when the body disappears, that's when you can focus on the mind instead, and the meditation can start to take off. To see on this retreat if you can find that middle way between pleasure and pain, I would recommend you that if you have any doubts exactly where that middle way is, don't be afraid of sleeping a little bit extra or having an extra cup of tea or whatever, Because that is only a tiny little bit of pleasure, tiny little bit of thing. It's nothing very much at all. So don't be afraid of... I think it's better to go wrong on the side of a little bit of indulgence than to go wrong on the side of being too strict on yourself. So rather than being too strict on yourself, make sure that you are comfortable, first of all. So that is just very briefly about the middle way. Try to find that middle way during this retreat if you can, and then hopefully you can get some good results in your meditation practice. Now, another thing which I like to talk about on meditation retreats, and this is also very important in monastic life, and this is to do every day a little bit of loving-kindness meditation, metta meditation, in particular to the people around you, your co-retreatants, because it is so easy to get a little bit irritated, a little bit upset by what other people around you do. We're all different. We all have different ideas of what is right and wrong. And somebody does something slightly different from what you're used to, and you might get a little bit upset or irritated by that. So remind yourself when you're here that the people you're with here are people who are dedicated people, people who have good hearts, good intentions, who want to do something positive in the world, who want to purify themselves. That's why they're here on this retreat. Remind yourself of that and make that a strong perception in your mind, something which is powerful, that you see the people around you in this way. And when you see them in this way, it's like you're setting up this barrier between you and negative states of mind. It's like a dike which stops the waves of ill will from washing in of your mind. And that is a very powerful and very useful thing. So if you can, when you feel good about yourself during the day, maybe after hearing a talk by Ajahn Brahm, or after the question and answers in the evening, when you feel relaxed, you feel at ease, do a little bit of that metta meditation. Wish everybody here well. May you all be happy. May you all be at peace. May you all be well. And then as you do that, you will find that the whole retreat is so much more smooth, so much more easy. And so everything flows much more easily all the way through. And this is also one of the things in monastic life. When you read the suttas, you read what the Buddha said. The Buddha always said that in monastic life, one of the most important things to do is to make sure you have that sense of loving kindness towards your fellow monastics. That you have a sense not only in public, when you're with them, that you're kind to them, you speak to them in a kind way, you act to them in a kind way, but also in private, he said, when you're by yourself, you have thoughts of kindness and intentions of kindness towards your fellow monastics. And in a way, on this retreat, you're all basically here like a bunch of nuns and monks, basically. There isn't that much difference between you and the way we live in the monastery. So take that advice of the Buddha to heart. Remember that these are your fellow monastics that you're living with here. And as the Buddha said, you should have thoughts, you should have words, and you should have actions of loving kindness towards your fellow monastics. And then, as it says in the suttas, you blend like milk and water, and you view each other with eyes of affection, and it becomes very nice and harmonious retreat when you do things in that way. And harmony is so important. It's so important to have harmony. And this is one of the things I always value with the monastery across the road. It's a very harmonious place. Ajahn Brahm said it's a very good example in harmony. And the Buddha said in the suttas that if you don't have harmony, you can't have a good meditation. It depends on harmony, that good meditation practice. Because when you have a sense of harmony, then you have a sense of joy in your heart. When you have that sense of joy, then that is the spark which gives rise to meditation. That joy comes from that sense of harmony. When people have ill will against each other, they are irritated by each other, then you cannot have that joy. That is the opposite of joy, to have ill will and irritation. So try to give rise to that harmony, rise to that beautiful sense of blending like milk and water, as it says in the suttas. Now, one of the ways of having loving kindness to the people around you is first of all remember that you're all very different here. You're different people with different backgrounds, with different temperaments. Some of you are going to be experienced meditators. Some of you are going to be here for the first time. Some of you will be doing well. The meditation is going to go well. Others will struggle in the meditation practice. Keep that in mind. Keep in mind that people are different from you. And give them a lot of slack. Give them a lot of compassion and understanding. So that you don't allow yourself to get upset when they do things in a different way from what you think is right. Remind yourself you don't really know what this person needs. They need something different from you. And then you can have a sense of compassion, and a sense of kindness, rather than getting upset by different ways of doing things. And one of the things on a retreat like this is that some of you would like to be very peaceful and silent all the time. Others may want to talk occasionally because you may find that being silent so much can be a bit oppressive. But remember that one of the beautiful ways of looking at a retreat like this, think about those people around you who are good meditators. Think about other people who want to be silent. And think that you will offer them silence as your gift to these people. I will be silent because I want to help the other people on this retreat. This is my gift to them. So instead of allowing quietness and not speaking to be something oppressive in your life, so make it into a beautiful gift to the people around you. And then you can change your perception of this silence and make it something beautiful rather than something which is negative and harsh. Of course, if you find that it is difficult to be silent, that you need to talk to somebody, and you have a particular friend that you normally talk to on this retreat, then of course do so. But maybe take them aside, go somewhere where nobody else is around, and then have a chat if you feel the need that you have to do that. Again, you want to avoid the kind of pressure, the kind of painful sensations at all costs. So if you have to do that, then do it. But take into account the other people who want to be peaceful. I was going to read out a short sutta for you, a short discourse by the Buddha. And this is actually a discourse that I read out to the monks during the rains retreat this year. And this came about, I was thinking the other day, about one very famous Thai monk in Thailand. And he used to give a very, very simple meditation teaching here. And this is a meditation teaching that you can also keep in mind. And his teaching was like this. Breathe in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. That was the whole teaching here. That was his teaching. And this word, sabai, is a Thai word, which basically means to be at ease, to be relaxed, to be comfortable. But I think essentially it means to be at ease. So what he was saying is that all you have to do, all meditation is all about, is to be at ease. Breathe in, be at ease. Breathe out, be at ease. If you can do that, you can meditate. But of course, the problem is that if you can do it, great. But most people find that difficult to do that. Meditation is really so simple. It's the simplest thing in the world. All you have to do is breathe in and breathe out and be at ease. Can't be much simpler than that. And yet, people can't do it. Why is it that you can't do it? And the reason you can't do it is not because you haven't understood the technique. It's not some kind of complex technique or anything. There is only one reason why you can't do it. And that is because there are defilements in the mind that stop you, that block you from actually being able to watch the breath. That is the only reason why you can't do it. So remember that. If you find yourself, you sit in meditation, and you cannot do the breathe in, sabai, breathe out, sabai, the reason you can't do it is because there is some kind of blockage, some hindrance in the mind which stops you from being able to do that. So sometimes what we have to do is that we have to undo some of these blockages in the mind. And of course, the standard way of looking at the blockages from the Buddha is as the five hindrances. And of these five hindrances, there's two most important ones are ill will and desire, sensual desire. And of ill will and sensual desire, the worst one by far is ill will. So look at yourself, look at your mind, reflect back on what kind of defilements that you tend to have in lay life, what kind of people maybe irritate you, you find difficult, what situations you find are hard. And then try and see if you can change the way you relate to that particular person. On a retreat like this, you have a lot of time. So sometimes all you have to do is to walk back and forth on the walking path or in the forest or wherever you want. And ask yourself, where are your problems? What are the things which tend to be problematic for you in life? Where are your irritations? What are the people that you find difficult to deal with? And now, while you're here in Perth at this retreat center, you're far away from your ordinary life, you're far away from the people that are normally around. And because of that, you can get some perspective on your ordinary life. And you can look at things in a new way. You can change your perception of things. And you can actually start reminding yourself that these people who are difficult, you can start to see maybe the good side in those people. And when you change your perception about other people and you start to see other aspects in them, or even if you can't see anything good in them, at least you can have compassion towards them. When you do that, you start to unblock some of those blockages in meditation. And when you undo those blockages in meditation, next time you sit down, if you are successful, you find that the meditation goes deeper because you have taken away something which is problematic, which causes you to stop in your meditation practice. And by changing your perception, changing the way that you look at other people or look at other situations, that perception makes you think differently about these other people. Instead of then having thoughts going around in your mind thinking negative things, you start thinking positive things, or at least neutral things instead. Because the perception is what gives rise to the thinking afterwards. And you find out your whole attitude, your whole mindset becomes more positive and more beautiful. So this is one of the things that you can do on a retreat like this. And you will find it has great benefits also later on when you come back to ordinary life. So I'm going now to read out this sutta for you. I will explain it as I go along. And this sutta is basically about how to overcome anger and ill will and negativity. And because it is spoken by the Buddha, not by the Buddha, but Venerable Sariputta, it is, in my opinion, very powerful things. And these are things that you will have heard before, but nevertheless, I think it's important to maybe to reinforce some of these things. So this sutta is called Removing Resentment. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's from a translation which is soon going to be published by Wisdom Publications in the US. So this sutta goes as follows. There, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends, bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by means of which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. What five? Here, friends, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is impure. Is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but he does not gain openness of mind, placidity of mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So there's five types of persons here, and that's just the summary of the sutta. And now Venerable Sariputta goes on to explain each one of these categories. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose, friends, a ragged robe bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off the intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is impure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here you have this is one of those old ways which is often mentioned by people, how to overcome anger or negativity towards somebody, is to focus on the good aspect of a person. And you will find that most people, a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people have good aspects. And by good aspects, we don't mean good worldly aspects, we mean good spiritual aspects. So you see somebody's generosity, you see their kindness, their compassion, their virtue, their wisdom. These are the things that you look for in other people. And when you see these beautiful spiritual characteristics, that is what you focus on. But the difficulty with this, and this is one of the things that you have to keep in mind, is that it's not easy to see the good in people often. It's not easy if somebody upsets you. It's not easy to turn your mind often towards that beautiful aspect of that person. So you have to practice. You have to do it again and again, remind yourself of the good aspect of this person. And as you do it again and again, it becomes like a force in your mind, something very strong and powerful. And when it becomes a force in your mind, then it becomes again like this barrier which stops the anger or the negativity or the irritation to arise in the future. So try, don't give up easily, this is something that you really have to work with and work hard at. But when you're able to do this, it becomes a very powerful thing. And even people that before you thought was very difficult to have positive perception towards, suddenly you find you can actually see the good in these people as well. This is a very, very useful thing. Venerable Sariputta, he talks here about verbal behavior being pure and the bodily behavior being impure, so you focus on the verbal behavior. But I take this just to be an example, and that you can actually focus on anything in that person which is good. Any kind of spiritual, beautiful quality in that person you can focus on, and that way overcome any kind of resentment or ill will. It's interesting here, it talks about the ragrog bhikkhu, who finds a rag on the roadside. And the ragrog bhikkhu, in those days, you had certain monks who practiced a very kind of severe lifestyle. And one of those lifestyles was just to make your robes out of rags. You would find a discarded cloth on the roadside, and you would use that to make robes from. They would go to the charnel ground, to the place where the corpses were being burnt, and they would take any remaining cloth that had been used for wrapping the corpses, and they would use that and make robes out of that. So some of those monks were quite ascetic in those days. And even now, sometimes you find that there are monks who use rags to make robes with. And that can be a good thing, even in this present day. Anyway, so this is the first type of person, and then we will move on to the second type. Next, friends, how should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is impure? Suppose, friends, there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. Having plunged into the pond with both hands, he would sweep away the algae and water plants, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here it is like you are pushing away with your hands the algae in the same way you're pushing with your mind away those negative things, those bad perceptions, and just focusing purely on the good side of this person instead. Same principle as in the last one. But how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains openness of mind, placidity of mind? Suppose, friends, there is a little water in a puddle. Then a man might arrive, afflicted, oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or from a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and then depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks it up like a cow, and then departs. So too, when a person's verbal behavior and bodily behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the openness of mind, the placidity of mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here is a person who is not a very good person. They say bad things and they do bad things, at least occasionally. But he gains what it says here, placidity of mind and openness of mind. And this is basically just means that occasionally their meditation works out. They're able to abandon the hindrances. They're able to abandon negative states of mind. And they have a sense of peace because they're able to abandon these negative states of mind. So here, in this particular case, if you know that somebody has occasionally gets this kind of state, you can focus even on that, even if you cannot see too much good actions in terms of actions and speech. There is still that beautiful aspect of just the mental tranquility here. And it's interesting here, you can see the simile here makes it very clear that you have to be very careful in this case. You have to narrow down your focus on a very small area where this person has positive qualities. Just like you get down on all fours and you suck the water up from a puddle in the ground, in the same way, you narrow down your focus and just focus on this one area where this person has done something nice, where they have a beautiful quality. It's like a person who may not be a very good person, who may have done many bad things in their lives, but then you can remember maybe one or two beautiful things that they have done. Maybe an act of generosity, maybe an act of kindness, an act of compassion towards somebody. And that is enough for you to focus on something. And when you put your attention on that, you can actually remove the negative perceptions that you may have in your mind. What comes to mind right now is a beautiful example of this is there was a man, this is at the time of the Buddha, who approached the Buddha and asked, Master, can I please get the going forth? Can I please be allowed to become a monk in your dispensation, in your teaching? And the Buddha asked around all the monks and said, well, what do you think? And the monks were saying, no, this man is no good. He has no good qualities. You know, they were all very doubtful about this man. And then the Venerable Sariputta, the same man who is the same monk, Buddha's chief disciple, who's teaching this sutta here, he says, I remember one occasion when this man gave me alms food. And then the Buddha says, look at Sariputta, look at the example of this Arahant, how he remembers with gratitude even this one little action, one little thing, putting a little bit of alms food in his bowl. He remembers that with gratitude, and now he's willing to allow this man to go forth because of that. So this is like the kind of example that you can take. One little act which is beautiful, that is enough for you to have somewhere to focus your mind on. Then we have the next type of person here. Now it gets very difficult, because this type of person does not really have many good qualities at all. Next, friends, how should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and who does not gain openness of mind, placidity of mind, from time to time? Suppose, friends, a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district, in other words, somebody who could help him. Another man traveling along the same highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district." For what reason? So that this man does not encounter misery and calamity right here. In other words, so he doesn't die right here because he's very ill. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time openness of mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one here means anybody, not just monks, but anybody, abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior." For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, this venerable one will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So there you are. This is like the foolproof method. Even if somebody doesn't have any kind of good qualities, you can always have compassion for them. Because you know, not only will they have a bad rebirth in the future if they have so many bad qualities, but usually they also have a miserable life right here and now. Somebody who is a bad person in all respects, generally speaking, they have a miserable life. They feel pain in the mind, pain in the body. They have negative perceptions. They look at the world in a negative way. And the life is generally no good. So because of that, if you focus on their pain, if you focus on their future destiny in a negative, and understand how much suffering they will reap in the future, you can transform any negativity, any ill will, into compassion instead. This is one of the ways of doing it. One of the problems in life is that we tend to take things so personally. If somebody does something bad, we tend to think, "Oh, they are being bad towards me. It's personal. They are after me. They don't like me," or whatever. But the important thing in Buddhism is to take that sense of personality out of the equation. If somebody is bad, it's nothing to do with us. The reason somebody is bad is because of them. It's because of their defilements, because of their problems. And we know this is true if we accept the Buddhist teachings of non-self. There's nobody in here who sort of says, "Oh, I will go after that person." It's just conditions. It's just that we have been conditioned in a certain way. This person has been under the influence in a certain way, that they act in this particular fashion. It's got nothing to do with us. So take the personality, take the sense of me against them, they are doing something against me. Take that out of the equation. It's never personal. It's always just a function of conditions, of the way people have been influenced in the past, the way they grew up, the kind of friends they had, the way they had it at school, the way their parents were, from their past life. This is why they are the way they are. It's not because they are going after you or there is something with you which is wrong or anything. There's nothing personal there, basically. Take that out of the equation. When you take that out of the equation, it's much easier to have a sense of compassion for that person. So those are the first four. Then we get to the last category here of these five. And the Venerable Sariputta says, next, friends, how should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who does from time to time gain openness of mind, placidity of mind? Suppose, friends, there is a pond with clear water, with sweet, cool, clean water, with smooth banks, delightful, shaded by various kinds of trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit or lie down right there in the shade of a tree. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, his pure verbal behavior, and to the openness of mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So this is the last type of person, and this is the type of person it's easy to have goodwill towards, because this is a person who has lots of good qualities. And I recommend, if when you do your metta meditation, start off with somebody who you have a lot of positive perceptions about, because then it's easy to have a sense of metta and kindness towards such a person. Start off with somebody like that. And the point here of this last line is that when you are lucky enough to meet a person like this in the world, somebody who is pure in almost every which way, then you have a foundation for placing confidence in that person. And that becomes a very powerful thing, because you read in the suttas that the way to decide where you place your confidence, where you place your trust, where you place your faith, is always in the person that are free from defilements. So if you see somebody who doesn't have any anger, who doesn't really have any greed, who has a lot of good, positive, good qualities, that is always the place where you should place your confidence. Don't just follow the crowd. Don't just think what everybody else says. This must be a great person, therefore it must be a great person. Forget about what other people say. Look for yourself. Have that trust in your own ability to judge who is a good person. And when you find such a person, take that as a treasure in life, because it is something which you can use as a foundation for your meditation practice, for building up a sense of confidence in this path of Buddhism. It's a very powerful thing, a very important source to have that sense of confidence somewhere. Of course, the ultimate confidence is always in the teachings of the Buddha, and that's why I like to read these things out. But it's also useful to have an example in life, somebody around you that you can see, because then you have a sense that the path works. You have this feeling that, wow, it's not just an ancient teaching, but it actually is alive. It works even now in the present day, 2,500 years after the Buddha. And that becomes very powerful and very important in life. And I think, for me at least, it has been one of the most important things for me to have that combination of being able to read the suttas and also see the example in real life of people having some of those qualities that the Buddha was talking about. So that is the last kind of person, and this is the person who it is easy to move resentment towards. But the funny thing, you find that even towards these people, sometimes you get resentment. Even towards arahants, you get resentment sometimes. You feel a bit stupid, because if you think somebody is an arahant and you get upset with them, you know who is to blame. It's not the arahant. It's usually just your own defilements. So don't get angry with yourself for getting angry. Don't get upset. Just slowly turn your mind back to a neutral state and see the positive in that person. Of course, you can never really know who is an arahant anyway. So maybe it could be that there is some defilement there, which you have seen in any case. Anyway, so that is that sutta about overcoming defilements. And then the Venerable Sariputta finishes off and he says, "These, friends, are the five ways of removing resentment by means of which a bhikkhu," you can also add here bhikkhuni, layman or laywoman, whoever basically, "can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen." So that is the sutta. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything much more, unless anybody has any questions perhaps. I can just finish off the evening with some questions if you like. Does anybody want to say anything or have any questions before we finish off? You're all very content and happy here, yeah? Okay, great. So, yes, sorry, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Or then you could have another type of metta meditation where you're putting the metta, say, between the meditation object. Well, that would be the two extremes, and then you could have things in between that.
Sure. Okay, well, it's very simple. The only pros and cons. The pro is whatever works is pro. Whatever doesn't work is con. That's as simple as that. Yeah. So just find out what works for yourself. Sometimes you have to try a few things, you try a few different objects, and you find out some work, some don't work. And that's why when I go through this, you try. Some people prefer animals, because with animals often, you don't have, with people, you can always see, you can very easily see the negative aspects in people. Animals, you can often just see the suffering. Actually, when you live in a monastery long enough, you see the negative things in animals as well. Because they are greedy, they are angry, they have exactly the same kind of emotions as we have as human beings. And after a while you start to see that in animals. But so you have to try different things. And then whatever you find works, stick with that. And then after a while you find out what used to work doesn't work anymore. Because it's like it gets used up in a sense. You get so familiar with it, it stops to work. And then you have to change again. You have to try a different way of doing things. So you have to experiment a little bit. And you have to sort of be persistent. And very often you won't get anything. You will sit there saying, "May you be happy." You won't feel anything at all. That happens a lot of the time. And then you have to maybe look at your perceptions. Can you perceive something differently? Can you build up the sense of good qualities in your mind about this person? Can you look at them in a different way to build it up? So there's a lot of things that you have to do. It's the only way that metta is going to work is if you have a positive perception of the person you're sending metta towards. It's really the only way it's going to work. If you have a negative perception, it's not going to work. Yeah. Anything else anybody wants to ask? Yes. Okay. Well, I think probably Ajahn Brahm will probably give you some good instructions tomorrow morning. Yeah. But basically, the thing is that you have to get your mind to a level, to a state where it is basically peaceful, where it is at ease, where it is relaxed, and where you feel at ease with yourself. And when you get to that state, when the mind is at ease, then you can start doing things like the breath meditation, watching the breath and that sort of thing. So the first thing to do is to get to that point when you feel, you sit here and you're just enjoying the silence basically here. There's not much thinking happening in your mind. Your mind is quite nice and clear. There isn't any anger or upset. There is no strong desires. You're just feeling very relaxed and at ease. And then when you get to that stage, then you can focus very carefully, bring onto the breath. And then if it's the right time and the right place, it will be quite easy to watch the breath. But first you have to get to that stage. And that is the hard part, to get to that stage. And the most important thing is that you will find it depends on how you've been living your life beforehand, whether you can even get there. People who haven't been living a very good life, or people who are maybe a little bit depressed maybe, or whatever, they find it very difficult to get to that stage where the mind is just clear and quiet and peaceful. Why? Because there's a sense of remorse there. There's a sense of negativity in mind which makes it difficult. And this is where you get to the thing that you have to integrate the Buddhist practice into your life. And that's where keeping precepts and being a kind and compassionate person in daily life is so important. Because only if you have that foundation is your meditation going to work when you come to a retreat like this. And you find out, when you're here, you find out how good your ordinary life is. Because if your meditation works well, you know that you are quite a good person. And you come back next year, you try again, and you see, it's a little bit better than last year. I must be doing something right. You know you're doing the right thing, right? And every year, if you're doing the right thing, it should be a little bit better every year. Don't measure yourself against some kind of ideal. Don't think that you should have this, or you should have that, or you should have lots of joy or lots of peace. The only measure is to make sure that you're making progress. You're better this year than you were last year. That is the only measure which matters. Because everything else is going to be different from person to person. So the trick really is just to start off the meditation retreat by just being at ease, being relaxed, feeling peaceful, doing a bit of loving kindness towards the people around you, and allowing yourself to settle down, to become peaceful, until you're able to do some more refined meditation, like watching the breath. So, but ask the master tomorrow when he comes, and then he might give a different answer. Yeah. So you get a different answer from different people. Yeah. Okay, anybody else wants to ask anything before we close off? Everybody happy? Okay, so maybe we should just pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we can call it an evening.